return to the Miller Center. Some of you remember the memorable occasion in which he received the Burkett Miller Annual Prize. In the course of that ceremony, while he discussed the question of presidential transitions as an area for inquiry. And we've looked to that discussion as an example of the kind of wisdom that he brings to bear on problems that are relevant to the Miller Center. The history of his visit is a little different than most things we do at the center. The late Douglas Cater, just weeks before he passed away, had proposed that the Miller Center look at some of the great books that have been written on the presidency and aspects of governance. And we had originally planned to have a discussion of Doug Cater's book on the fourth branch of government, the role of the media, as well as Professor Neustadt's book on presidential power and the modern presidents. Doug Cater is no longer with us. We were very anxious to go forward with that plan, and Professor Neustadt, who had planned a trip to this country at this time, kindly consented to do so. I think probably most of you were present when Jim Young presented the Burkett Miller Prize and gave a very full and elegant account of Professor Neustadt's career. I won't try to match that. But I do want to say that this is a great book for many of us, even those of us who are not full-time presidential scholars. In reviewing the book in the last few days, I was struck with the fact that most of the issues that the Miller Center has either considered or thought of considering are dealt with in the book. Not only presidential transitions, but recently we've been talking about a revisiting and updating of an evaluation of the way checks and balances and separation of powers operates. And there's a very full discussion not only of the concept of checks and balances between the branches of government in presidential power, but an example of the manner in which individual presidents, and interestingly enough, at the end of that discussion, President Johnson and President Nixon dealt with the issue. And so with almost every other issue that we've been concerned with, why either we looked at some of the pages before embarking on these efforts, or we would have been better off if we had in the course of the administration of these activities. When you ask yourself why one goes back to any great book, there obviously are enduring qualities. There are themes that, such as the ones I've mentioned, which recur, but there's something else. And again, in the presentation of the Burkett Miller Prize, this was singled out. The great hazard in the social sciences, that is not necessarily a hazard elsewhere, is that the observer gets too far from the patient in the bed, namely the realities of politics. And cycles move across the spectrum of each of the disciplines. There's this tendency to move either too strongly in the direction of the theorist or too aggressively and limitingly focus to the participant, but Richard Newsted has been a participant observer throughout his career, and it marks this important book, and we therefore are pleased, and it is altogether proper that in the first of what may be several discussions of great works in the public affairs, especially the presidency field, that we have this opportunity to share an hour with Dick Newsted, who throughout the history of the Miller Center has been a good friend and a wise counselor. We're delighted that you're here, Dick, and look forward to a discussion.
Thank you very much, Ken. And I hope I'm, you know, can be heard by everyone. If there's a problem, you know, just wave your hand in the back and I'll get closer to that thing. Doug Kinger published in 1959 a book called The Fourth Branch of Government, which dealt with the Washington Press Corps, in particular the White House Press, and its relation to the conduct of government. And the next year I published the first edition of Presidential Power, and we read each other's manuscripts. So a year ago we were talking about this, and Doug conceived the notion that there were some connections here. That it would be fun if we got together at the Miller Center and talked about what's changed, and how would those changes in the society and the government and the media affect what we had written? Would we change our writing now? So I think that is my theme for the day in Doug's absence. And you'll see the connection as I go between his focus and mine. I don't think our answers would have been the same, but that's another matter. I'm glad to be back at the Miller Center, and I'm only sorry that Doug Kinger can't be here. Now, the original version of Presidential Power had a focus built around sex assertions. Let me just run through those briefly so we know where I begin. First, that the modern president is at the center of an enormous range of expectations. Expectations from constituents, both foreign and domestic, both partisan and national. Expectations, some of which are embodied in statute, other of which are embodied in custom, all of which are either to be inflamed by events. And that presidents are impelled to try to act on a large proportion of those expectations, although their formal constitutional and statutory authority does not, in any sense, give them an assured capacity to follow through. They are therefore, as in the terms I used, they are bound to be clerks. Clerks in the service of those who hold the expectations. Whether or not they can manage to be leaders is an open question. But that they are clerks is beyond question in the modern situation. The effort to satisfy the demands of constituents, using that term broadly, in our Madisonian system, a system in which institutions are separated and have to share formal powers, a situation in which the institutions are competitive for power, to borrow of a term now appropriately in use. In such a situation, presidents can rarely command. And if they command effectively, can only do so at considerable cost. Most of the time, they have to attempt to persuade others who have the capacity to resist. Either congressmen or or judges or interest groups or members of the press corps, all protected by the Bill of Rights, or corporations, trade unions, Wall Street, as the case may be, or foreign governments. And persuasion of such people, who are never merely one's creatures, has three overlapping sources. First is formal power of constitutional, statutory, and customary authority. Relatively objective, although subject to independent interpretation by the president, by Congress, and by judges. The veto, for example. A classic but useful example at the present time. Second is what I term the professional reputation of a president in the minds of those who have the doing of what he wants done in Congress or anywhere else among those people I have named. Their view of his skill and his determination, his will, to use the formal powers they acknowledge that he has. You have all seen recent examples of this. Until the middle of last year, Mr. Clinton's professional reputation was such, judged on his previous observed behavior, that he would not wield the veto, that he could be pushed around, that he did use the veto, and his reputation has somewhat altered accordingly. Reputation is no substitute for the individual judgment of individual actors who have the doing of what a president wants, but always among those continuously involved in government, there's an effort to ascertain and to make judgments based on the overall view of the man's skill and will. And third, as a source of power, of practical influence on the course of government, is public prestige, the president's popularity, his public standing, insofar as it is relevant to the people he is trying to persuade, insofar as his public overlaps their publics, so they have some reason to care whether he's popular or not. These are sources of persuasiveness with the people who have the conduct of government in their hands, or who substitute in the private sector for government in areas like communication and the economy. The president can't help as a clerk, but endeavor to press actions of certain sorts upon these people, whatever his personal proclivities. He has nothing but these means to work with, and he exercises them through his own choices. That's what he has to do with. His choices of his own schedule, his own appointees, the measures he espouses, the words he uses, the timing he chooses. Any president is a choice machine in those terms. That's what he does all day, or he delegates the doing to others. And it is through those choices that he manages either to be persuasive or not, that he combines formal powers with the reputation his choices cumulatively create and with the popularity he has or risks or loses. Now, this being the case, it behooves him to think as he makes a current choice, to think ahead about the possible consequences of that choice on his reputation and his popularity. And to ponder the implications for prospective influence, prospective power, if you will, of current choice, and to derive clues from that consideration for policy. Clues he may not be able to apply because the substantive considerations may overwhelm power considerations, but which at least serve as cautions for the future. Now, it's a complicated thing to think in terms of a current choice about its prospective effect on reputation and popularity. But there's no one who can do it better than a president. At least that's the assertion in presidential power, because he is at least elected by a national constituency. His responsibilities encompass the most dangerous and decisive exercises of governmental authority, the use of force overseas. And he has a worldwide set of constituents, unlike anybody else in the system, especially unlike staff. Staff are often thought to be the answer to complex issues that presidents must think about. Staffs have two disabilities. One, staff tend to be more holy than the Pope, more royalist than the King. And two, staffs tend to import into his neighborhood all sorts of second-level business they, not he, consider decisive and important or soothing to their egos, regardless of his. So presidential power contended originally that in making the subtle calculation of prospective consequences for power in current choices, nobody was more expert than an elected president. And one ought to cheer him on his way. Now, in the book as it now stands, after five editions, a number of adjustments have been made in that thesis. Let me just run briefly through what they are. In chapter 11, these subsequent chapters deal with presidencies since the original publication of the book since 1960. And as we've proceeded through history, I've learned some things I didn't understand before. First, in chapter 11, makes the point that at the outset of a presidential term, a new president and his people are both quite charmingly, innocently, ignorant and arrogant. And that the combination of ignorance, arrogance, of adrenaline flowing, lack of knowledge of what, of where they are and what they're doing, can blot out the capacity to think intelligently about professional reputation and prestige. I used as illustrations the Bay of Pigs in Mr. Kennedy's time, and the Lance Affair in Mr. Carter's. I could now, or I'm rewriting it, use a dozen instances from Mr. Clinton's early months, starting with his answer to a question on the second day after his election about what he would do about gays in the military. Chapter 10 makes the point that even experienced presidents who are over their ignorance and have had their arrogance tempered will find the clues to policy they derive from considerations of power less useful than my original thesis suggested. Less useful because the sources of influence are sufficiently varied. Constitutional authority plus reputation plus prestige, that in any complex choice involving complicated issues of policy, complicated issues of substance, the clues derived from power considerations are likely to diverge and to suggest both affirmative and negative choices at the same time. And they tend to diverge in a characteristic way. The immediate risks, being most concrete, are the ones that seem most necessary to heed. The risks that point in the opposite direction, and there are always risks that do, of a longer run character, being in the future somewhat indeterminate, can be overlain by hope, or at least they can be postponed to worry about in the future. So the tendency is to be over-influenced by immediate risk and to undervalue longer-run risk. And if that's a tendency, then the utility of considering one's power stakes at all, as clues to policy, is lessened. I use as my examples Mr. Johnson's Americanization of the Vietnam War in 1965. And the risks he saw and worried about, both immediate and longer run. And Mr. Nixon's decisions to first establish and then continue a cover-up in the Watergate case, the immediate and the longer run, cutting in opposite directions and suggesting opposite courses of action. I'm going to offer you in a moment a couple more. One from the 60s and one from the 90s, which have the same characteristic. So, if my original thesis doesn't do a president much good, or if the good it can do him is limited. It rather lessens the utility of this work, at least for presents. I have asked in chapter 13, written in 19, or published in 1990, what else can a president use? Trying to think ahead about his prospective power, besides the clues he derives from the immediate situation. But I've suggested that if he has relevant experience, it can be enormously helpful. As with the case of Mr. Eisenhower, in avoiding entanglement in French Indochina in 1954, the time of Dien Bien Phu. And if he hasn't got experience but has learned to ask good questions of those who do, he can derive vicarious experience, as Mr. Kennedy did in the midst of the Cuban Missile Crisis. But we have a nominating process that is most unlikely to produce presidents whose experience is particularly relevant to the choices they will encounter. We may be lucky in certain cases, but I, if you look back over recent nominations, you will not see many. And therefore, I'm forced to ask, what else can a president use besides his clues to power and his experience? Well, I've asked that question in chapter 12 with respect particularly to Ronald Reagan, the most interesting exception to the usual run of presidents we've had so far, but an exception I expect to see repeated sooner or later. Here's a man who brought in with him a limited number of firm commitments and used them as lodestars throughout his period of office. Most presidents derive their commitments from the choices history puts on them as they go. He brought most of his in with him and took them away at the end. And beyond those commitments, he was, for the most part, extraordinarily incurious and therefore perfectly willing to delegate vastly. And let the expectations pouring in upon him be handled by others with his blessing. He was also enormously experienced in taking direction and reading scripts. And he handled the public relations of the presidency better than any other recent president. I'll come back to that in a moment. But beyond his talent for PR, he did have a mechanism to counter his incuriosity with respect to his prospective power. He did have someone, a special sort of staff person, continuously watching out, continuously and selflessly watching out for his public standing and his place in history, and thinking about nothing else. And that was Mrs. Reagan. And if we ever get another president who, beyond his own commitments, is equally incurious, then my recommendation is never let your Nancy be immobilized, as she was in the case of the Iran-Contra diversions, because it was a matter of super secrecy. She couldn't find out in the press. Or if for reasons of state she must be immobilized, that is the moment to get into the detail yourself. So I've added that as my final advice to the next Ronald Reagan. Now, would I make further changes today? There are some minor things I won't bore you with. But in a major way, giving the original thesis and these amendments, would I change now? The answer is I think not. And think not. And this is very surprising. This would have been very surprising to Doug Cater. Given the enormous changes in context in the period since the original writing of this book and of his book, 1960, 36 years ago. Just quickly consider some of them. That was a Cold War context. The Cold War is over. The nuclear threat, which was then beginning to be deeply experienced by presidents themselves, is gone for the time being, at any rate. And the congressional deference that followed Pearl Harbor is gone. Second, there's been a great growth in entrepreneurialism, individual entrepreneurialism, in legislating, in nominating, and in campaigning. The terms and conditions of our politics have been altered very considerably. Third, we live in a transformed economy. In 1960, we were right in the middle of a generation in which real incomes were rising and income disparities were narrowing. Now, we've lived a generation with the opposite. For two-thirds of the country, real incomes have been shrinking for a generation, and disparities in income have been rising. And some people have finally noticed. They noticed in the course of the last recession. And that changes the whole context of our politics. And that perhaps is the reason for, is a part of the reason for the rising suspicion of politics and government. This book came out in the year that Jack Kennedy was elected. Came out 6 months before his election. That was the year of maximum voting. In our experience since the 1920s. And it was also a year that heralded a period of maximum respect for engagement with government politics. It's been on the sharp decline ever since. Respect for both have dropped precipitously since. Finally, there's a thing Doug Cater would have talked to you about. The transformations in the media, related to, connected with, a continuing revolution in electronic communication. Just let me offer a few contrasts. In 1957, television homes first came to equal radio homes. In 1963, for the first time, network television news came to be a half-hour experience. In 1963, also, we had the first television spectacular, the 4 days after Kennedy's assassination. This is the original thesis of this book is really written in a pre-television era as we know it now. Wire service tempo governs the habits of the Washington Press Corps and the White House Press Corps, as against what's been true since 1970, the middle 1970s, live pictures on the evening television news, imported almost directly with not more than a half hour between the picture taking and the picture showing. The result of satellite transmission, of fast photographic development, and other technological innovations. So the 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock news is the deadline now. Oh, not what was the major deadline when that book was written. The morning and afternoon editions of newspapers. In 1960, the majority of the reporters at the White House were working stiffs. Now, the leading reporters at the White House are television celebrities. And every other reporter at the White House hopes, wants, expects, tries, engaged, and desiring to be a television celebrity. In 1960, as always since Roosevelt's time with radio, a president who wished to speak to the country had merely to advise the networks of his desire and promise that it was a non-political subject he had in mind, or transcended politics, and all the networks were available to him at a time of his choosing. Preemption was called, so that audiences on radio and television had only two choices. They could listen to the president or turn off the set. Now I know of two occasions last spring, and I'm sure I don't know of all, where the White House has gone hat in hand to the television networks and been told, sorry, you've got CNN, we need the revenue. We're not gonna run you. In the early 1960s, or the middle 1960s, it was estimated through polling that 65% of the American public got their news primarily through network television. By the middle 1970s, the late 1970s, that figure had risen above 80%. I'm told it is now down to 52%. And where do people get their news? Where do those people who have left the networks get their news? Well, nobody is entirely sure, but some through local television networks, which have the same satellite transmission as the national net. Some perhaps on internet, and some from talk show hosts. Nobody knows how many people now use talk shows as a primary news source. This means that everything is different in the world Doug Cader was writing about. And yet, I'm here asserting that nothing much has changed in the world I was writing about. Let me offer you, in closing, just two thought experiments. In 1965, late 1965, Lyndon Johnson made a choice to defer a request for tax increases to finance the extra costs of the war. He was, without acknowledgement, prosecuted in Vietnam. All his economists told him to go for tax increases. He refused. In 1993, Mr. Clinton chose to defer 6 weeks of intensive activity across, speaking on radio and television all across the country to expound and defend his newly presented health reform proposals. He chose to defer them in order to put his time, energy, and effort on NAFTA, which had to come up under the then legislation by a date certain, by December. Now, we know a good deal, though I don't claim to know everything, about the power stakes these presidents had in those decisions. both the stakes that counseled deferral and the stakes that counseled the opposite. And we know what they did. And we know that they both thought before they made those particular choices about their prospective power and how these choices might affect their power, and derive clues to policy from those calculations. Mr. Johnson saw, among other things, he saw the substantive argument, of course, but he saw, among other things, that as arguments for deferring tax increases. First, that if he went for tax increases, it would signal that there was a war and that this would give Congress an excuse for slowing down momentum on his Great Society legislation. And he thought he only had 1 year left to pursue that momentum, being the second year of his first session after his great victory. And he didn't want to slow the momentum down. Didn't want to offer an excuse. He also, this was reinforced by the embarrassment that in 1964 he had pushed through Kennedy's proposals for income tax reduction on the grounds that the economy would surge. Taxes went down, the economy was surging, taxes had gone down. How was he to go back 2 years later and argue on non-war grounds that an increase was needed? And finally, he was influenced by the assumption, which he still held at that time, that Ho Chi Minh was bound to come to understand that we didn't want much from him. We didn't want to hurt him. We just wanted him to leave the South alone for a reasonable time. And that we were prepared to offer great goodies if he would only do that. Hurt him if he wouldn't, but offer him the Mekong Delta Authority and $2 billion worth of development. And Ho, like any other senator, was likely to respond in due course. Not on the one side. On the other side, all the economists were saying, you've got to get ahead of the curve of inflation. You've got to take resources out of the economy. We are at full employment, it's going to heat up. Unless you increase taxes now, you're going to start an inflationary spiral that will be peaking at the time of the next election, 1968. And our various political advisors pointed out to him that he risked what we now call a credibility gap. If he presented a rosy picture of the economy in his January messages of 66, but within a year or two, inflationary pressures had produced the kinds of discomfort of which they are capable. And these things pointed in opposite directions. So he weighed them, and he did what I acknowledged in Chapter 10 most presidents will do. He heeded the immediate risks in hopes that the longer-term risks would go away. Now look at Clinton. Clinton, the arguments for deferring, apart from substance, the political arguments for deferring his planned 6 weeks of early campaigning for his health reform proposal, or that the NAFTA treaty was on a fast track legislatively, that would terminate in December. It was intervened to try to put the president's weight behind it now, or it might get lost. It was a bipartisan measure. It wasn't his measure. It was George Bush's measure. But was a bipartisan measure, and Wall Street was looking to see whether the president would or would not be responsible in promoting it. And if he went out and helped this essentially Republican proposal get through, then he ought to be able to get some reciprocity from the Republicans in the next session of Congress on things like health reform. But if he let George Bush's favorite treaty drop, he was in trouble with Republicans and with Wall Street. Market confidence and the prospect of bipartisanship were both bound up with this. So power considerations in those senses counseled. NAFTA was Mr. Bush's, it wasn't his, it wasn't Clinton's. Clinton's thing was this new health reform proposal, and he'd better get that. The unions were against NAFTA, but presumptive allies on health insurance, he'd better mobilize their support. The prospective opponents of health insurance, especially the small insurance companies and small business groups in general, were not yet mobilized in opposition. And Clinton better keep the pressure on. Keep making his case before they got a chance to make theirs. So, the arguments of power were pretty closely balanced. At least there were strong arguments on each side. And he made the decision to defer his campaign for health reform, spend his time campaigning for NAFTA. He got NAFTA. You all know what happened to health reform. If there was a chance, which there may not have been, to move some version of that measure. Most observers think it was lost by the failure to follow up in the fall of 93. In which case, he followed the wrong set of clues. But as I've said before, the clues diverge, and what are you going to do? You have to make a judgment by gut instinct. Now, I do not see that making that judgment by gut instinct is very different in one case than in the other case. You may tell me I'm wrong. If the problem is the same for both these presidents, and the capacity to make an error in favor of the immediate risks is the same, both these presidents, then the changes in the surrounding context and in the nature of the media do not seem to figure. So I judge from these two experiments, 30 years apart, that the presidential problem, however difficult it is, looking out upon a hard, relentless world, as LBJ thought his world was, just as much as Mr. Clinton thought his, the problem for a president in the post-Cold War period, in the period of technological revolution, mass communications, has not changed. It may be on the verge of changing, however. This is my last point to you. People have been predicting the coming of narrow casting. I don't know whether that's a familiar term to you or not. A situation which is not, we are not quite into, but we're on the verge of, in which the public, the national public, as it was understood in Eisenhower's time when that book was originally written, dissolves into a congeries of publics who get their news, their information, their understandings of the world from highly differentiated news sources, which have little to do with one another. And I think it's true now that if a portion of the public gets their news through talk shows, and another portion through network news, and another portion through CNN, and another portion through specialized magazines and print media, then we're getting close to a situation where public's understanding of the world are completely unrelated. If that happens, there will presently be no national public. And for the power calculations I discuss in there, in terms of public prestige, will have changed beyond recognition. So perhaps 5 years from now, 10 years from now, whenever it is, but I'm still hale and hearty, I'll have to come back here and say, I changed my mind. But I'm not ready to do it yet.
We have time for some questions. Who would like to ask the first question? Could I ask about your Eisenhower example? On Monday, we had a speaker who said, the great contribution of Neustadt is on risks of power. You and I have a mutual friend who said, the problem in Washington oftentimes is not so much the abuse, but willingness to use power by people who, particularly in the bureaucracy, who protect themselves in various ways. But you say that one of our most popular presidents hoarded power in one sense, at least, where Dien Bien Phu was concerned. I wondered if you'd say a word about that.
Well, there was a situation in which the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the vice president, and to some extent, at least, the Secretary of State, were all counseling the president that he ought to relieve the French, whose main forces were besieged at Dien Bien Phu. Some people wanted to use tactical nuclear weapons, other people, that was the most favored thought. Other people wanted to increase support for the French and, if necessary, intervene on the ground, certainly intervene from the air. And Mr. Eisenhower, at the very beginning of the discussions, interjected on his own motion the requirement that, of course, there'd have to be consultation, bipartisan consultation with Congress before action could be taken. Nobody in his bureaucracy could object to that. Whether he knew it or not, and many people think he did know it because he had a very good relationship with Sam Rayburn and Lyndon Johnson, but nobody knows whether he knew it or not. They, the minority leaders, were going to take the firm view that they would not support any intervention on behalf of the French unless the British would join and the French would immediately announce the end of colonialism in French Indochina, immediately announce independence. Now, whether Ike knew that before they were consulted or not, I don't know. Oh, if he didn't know it, he knew at least that he was out of a lot of trouble if these advocates in his administration had in mind had support in Congress. Now, he also may or may not have known. that if he consulted the British, they would have no interest in supporting intervention. They were off on a quite different tack of trying to save what could be saved through a conference with the Chinese and others in Geneva, and that the French were politically, domestically, in no position to make the promises that Rayburn and Johnson wished. Ike sent his Secretary of State, Foster Dulles, to Europe to look into the question. Some people think he knew perfectly well the answer to the question before he sent Dulles over there. Ike knew all the people one had to know in the British government and the French government to have been able to form a judgment on this matter without Dulles, just as he knew Rayburn and Johnson well enough to form a judgment without even asking them. Personal experience does count for something. But nobody knows whether he knew what answer Dulles would derive or not. What is known is that if those conditions had been met, and the Americans had intervened with the British to support the French after the French had declared their preparedness to leave Indochina at once, but whatever happened, even if we did intervene, Ike was free and clear. He had acted with Congress, he'd acted with our allies. He was free and clear of the kind of troubles Mr. Truman got into in Korea, Mr. Johnson got into in Vietnam. Truman's war, Johnson's war. It would never be Eisenhower's war. Now, there's no record that anybody advised him on any of this. I mean, on any of these particulars. This he had to suck out of his thigh. That simple, bland insistence that, of course, Congress has to be consulted. It is a glorious illustration of how you can consult something or other, power stakes, experience, instinct, something, and derive clues to your inestimable benefit. That's all.
Question? Darren Nectron?
That's a very interesting story, and I'm just tempted to ask you, isn't there a parallel in 1995-96 with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the vice president and the Secretary of State, at least Holbrooke, acting as the Secretary of State, urging the president to send U.S. troops to Bosnia, and the French president begging us to do it, the British being very reluctant to do it, but being willing to do it if we went with them. And in this case, the president decided the other way. Now, I'm not saying that the conditions are the same, but the test of presidential powers is rather similar, isn't it?
Well, it's hard for me to respond with any sense of being definitive because I was out of the country for a lot of this. But my impression is that we may have different impressions of the matter. That Mr. Clinton got himself boxed in 93. By first pressing for what was called lift and strike, something the British were never going to go for. The British and French, and they were the people who had forces on the ground in their humanitarian mission. And then, in order to show goodwill to NATO, Clinton pledged a contribution to a peacekeeping force if there were a peace agreement. In 95, he was stuck with that pledge. He didn't have to put forces on the ground on the humanitarian basis that the British and French had originally gone in there. But how was he going to get out of putting forces on the ground if there was an agreement? And indeed, he didn't. If Holbrooke had been unable to achieve an agreement, that would have relieved him. And we won't know for some months whether in letting Holbrooke bull his way through to an agreement, the president made a fearful mistake or not. I think the thing is open. But there's some people who believe that he may be in desperate trouble, he may lose the election because Holbrooke was able to achieve an agreement. And then he had to carry through that pledge. But we'll find that out. But it does illustrate the point that these things are risky, uncertain, that you've got clues on both sides, and you're likely to be damned no matter what the media does. Yeah.
Dr. Edgerton.
It would look like the line item veto may go through. In your next edition of the book, could you speculate on whether you think this is going to affect presidential power, significantly?
Oh, well, you know, I'll speculate.
I could be wrong. Ever since Mr. Truman's time when I was at the White House, I've been a deep skeptic about the virtues of the line item veto for the president. Because what the line item veto does is relieve Congress of all responsibility. And stick on the president, quite unprofitably from his point of view, the dirty work of antagonizing every interest group that Congress has chosen to conciliate. Now, how does that, I mean, is that going to add up to an increase in presidential influence? It certainly adds up to an increase in presidential authority, formal authority, formal powers, as I distinguish the term. But as for power, in the sense of influence on the course of events, I'm inclined to think that it may be a bad, from a president's point of view, presidents may look back and curse the day when they got the authority. Now it may not work out that way. Many governors who have this authority treasure. So, no, it's speculative.
Last question. Well, we certainly want to thank you. You, as usual, have been generous in an exemplary way, far beyond the call of duty, and coming all this way, and I think wherever he is, Doug Cater must be saying, couldn't have been any better. Thanks a lot.